Welcome to another edition of the ATL Alts Podcast, where we bring you the story behind the numbers. My name is Andre Sendate, and I am joined today by Kimberly Flynn, who's a Managing Director of Alternative Investments with XA Investments out of Chicago. I'm really excited to have Kimberly on our show today, and we're going to talk a lot about everything in the interval fund and closed-end non-listed fund space. I'm excited to have you on the show, Kimberly. Welcome to ATL Alts.
Thank you so much.
As I was sharing with you, as we were discussing the show, one of the things that I'm really excited about doing is providing education to our target audience at ATL Alts, which is a lot of financial advisors and some asset managers. So we have some overlap in terms of our audiences, but really those that are exploring and looking for education, information, and inspiration around alternative investments and startups in the private markets. And so I thought, when you reached out about us having this conversation, I said, let's record it as a podcast and let's try to provide as much education. On the screen, you can see a little bit of my background. I've spent, 15 plus years in alternatives. And we met, as we talked about, some years ago when XA was just getting launched. And so I can't wait to hear more about it. But that's enough about me. Let's talk about my guest. Kimberly, would you just take a minute and tell us a little bit about yourself? They can see your bio, but always great to hear a backstory.
Sure. Thank you so much. I'm the founder of XA Investments, and I'm a former Nuveen Investments person. I was really trained and mentored at Nuveen in product development specifically, and Nuveen is one of the market leaders in closed-end funds. And I've spent the last 8 years at XA Investments building a platform focused on alternatives and specifically around product design and product strategy for interval funds and other types of closed-end funds, which are a really great fit for less liquid or illiquid alternative investments.
And also becoming more and more popular as the data you shared with me in terms of background with financial advisors and with their end clients as a way to get access to things that we're going to talk about, like private credit and private equity and other specialized strategies. So we'll spend some time talking about that. Would you give some background, though? Because one aspect of ATL Alts is to really dive in with my guests to get a little bit more about what got them to that initial launching point in their career. So, did you grow up in the Chicago area? I see you went to Notre Dame, earned your MBA from Harvard, both with distinction. But I think it's always great to get to hear how you sort of chose this career path.
Sure. I've spent my life in the Midwest. I was born in Omaha, Nebraska, and I grew up in Edmond, Oklahoma. Okay. And my family is still in Oklahoma. They're Oklahoma Sooners fans. And, the career opportunities, I knew I could be a cattle rancher or a lawyer or a doctor in Oklahoma. And I was kind of attracted to business very early. And I did pursue a finance degree at Notre Dame. And I don't think I contemplated doing something, entrepreneurial or building a business. That came much, much later. I worked in investment banking right out of college at Morgan Stanley. And I've always had the benefit of terrific mentorship, primarily male bosses and male mentors who really taught me the ropes. And I actually now work with the people from Morgan Stanley that hired me out of college. They are now my bosses at my current position. Mm-hmm. They run the investment bank that my firm is part of. And so I found the value of that education and mentorship in my career. It's allowed me to take risks that I probably didn't think I was able or, willing to take. Nuveen Investments is a really wonderful place. It's actually a very conservative firm. And I knew I was sort of bumping up against some resistance in terms of my own personal ambitions. Nuveen at that time was not really focused on alternative investments. And that was sort of when I left, that was in the, you all may remember when liquid alternatives were sure. popular, things like commodity futures and managed futures. And so I knew I wanted to do more in the private markets space. That was a challenge for me personally. And so it's been a real pleasure. We've worked with a lot of different asset managers across a spectrum of alternatives, including farmland, building products for a variety of managers in private credit, private equity, venture capital. And it's really, for me, that's really always been the fun of the job is, you know, learning these different asset classes, the pros and cons, the benefits and the risks, but then being able to explain that to investors and effectively market these types of products. And so my career has always been really focused on product strategy. And I feel like I've been a good partner with many portfolio managers who frankly sometimes aren't the best people to you know, position what they do or help them raise capital. And so I see my job as, you know, one part product design, one part capital raising.
Yeah. Well, before we jump into all the exciting things at XA Investments and get deep into talking interval fund and the interval fund process and all the things that, you know, that go into not only setting up a fund, but just the feasibility, I have to ask you, because I grew up in the Midwest as well. I'm a Kansas native, grew up in a very small town. Mom and dad still live back there. And now we live in Atlanta. My family, we, you know, my wife and I, we have three kids. We're raising them in a big city, and it just feels a lot different when you're in a big city. And I can only imagine, you know, going back in time, right, to my, you know, my early youth. I want to ask you, was there anybody in your family, or you talked about the importance of mentors, but I think for those listening, particularly those younger professionals, women, people of color who may not have that network, may not grow up in an environment where finance and investing in Wall Street is the table discussion. Right. It's easy to look at our industry and see you have to go to a pedigreed school, you have to go to an Ivy League college, you have to work at a certain investment bank in order to get launched. You came from Edmond, Oklahoma, with all due respect. I know that community. I've been through Oklahoma 100 times. Kansas, a lot of communities that size. What would you say to the person before we get going in the podcast to allow them to understand like that path that you've chosen, that you've taken is possible for them too?
Sure. I think every decision, every choice we make opens up a whole nother set of opportunities. And, you know, growing up, I actually had a neighbor that I babysat for, and he was a commercial banker, you know, worked at one of the local banks, and he was a mid-level guy. And we were talking about my career aspirations, you know, as a 12 or 13 year old when I was babysitting for his kids. I said something about, well, maybe I'll be a commercial banker. And he said, no, he said, you should be an investment banker. So sometimes people plant ideas in your head. And so I said, okay, well, I'll go be an investment banker, not knowing at all what that job entailed, but just that it was a challenging, you know, lucrative type of an opportunity. And I did pursue that, and I tried it. And I didn't really like it that much, but that was okay. And I think that some people, I mentor a lot of college students and MBA students now, and I think they feel like there's so much pressure to make the right decision. Mm-hmm. And the reality is that, you know, you may not know until you've experienced the role or you've been there 6 months if it was the right fit, and that's okay. That's not on you. And so be open-minded with, you know, internships and opportunities. And you can always, I do like for people to spend some time, you know, spend 12 months, spend 24 months, you know, and take away something from every opportunity. You know, I don't necessarily suggest like flipping around, but that's the beauty of some of these internships. While you are in college or you are in graduate school, you can just try it and figure out, because sometimes your strengths line up better with a different role, and you won't know until you've tried. Yeah. So I do encourage people to be, have a sense of, you know, experimentation there. And you don't have to know ahead of time, because sometimes you have to try it to get comfortable and realize if it's a passion for you. And I always encourage people to figure out what is it that you're good at. I was a very good writer. I wrote for the paper in high school, and I wrote for a magazine in college. But in finance, there's not many people who like to write or can write. And so you, I think some of those things can help you develop an edge in an area that will advance what it is that you want to do. And so definitely encourage people to, you know, think about some of those things.
Yeah, no, that's most appreciated. Let's jump in and talk about XA investments. We find ourselves in an environment where who knows where the market's going, but there's no denying that alternatives and non-traditional diversifying strategies interest is certainly quite high. But before we dive into that and the numbers, tell us about XA Investments and what your firm is.
Sure. So we're an asset management firm, and we have two sides of our business. One is we have proprietary funds that are branded in our own name, and they are alternative credit funds. One is an interval fund, and one is a New York Stock Exchange listed closed-end fund. Because they're credit-focused, they're you know, alternative credit. The appeal there is that they're higher yielding than maybe traditional fixed income investments. And on the other side of our business, we have a consulting practice where we actually advise asset managers on product strategy, and we'll help them build interval funds. Or a lot of people come to us for interval fund assistance, but sometimes we end up helping them launch other types of alternative products as well.
Yeah, which we're going to spend some time getting into. Well, I appreciate that background. For the sake of today's conversation, what I thought we could do is we could take one of the pieces of content that you have made available, I believe, on your website, and I'm going to share it in the notes to our show after we finish our recording for those, and also, you know, direct folks to your website where they can access this. But I thought we would take the feasibility study approach and sort of talk about this in this 1 through 10 kind of, you know, bullet point format of, you know, I'm an asset manager. I have a strategy. Maybe I have a 3-year or a 5-year track record. And I want to talk about maybe expanding the reach of that product. I get introduced to Kimberly Flynn at XA Investments. I don't know if you follow this specific script here, but let's just start with high level. The retail alternative investment market trends, I alluded to this earlier. Can you just kind of give us a sense for how big is this market? Why is it growing? What are some of the drivers?
Sure. So I'll talk about the reasons for the market being in focus right now and the growth. And so if you think about individual retirees, you know, today, you know, the burden for saving for retirement is really on the shoulders of each American. It used to be, though, that there were pension funds that would provide for retirees. And so the shift in the investment space is largely driven by this shift from defined benefit programs, which were pensions, to defined contribution plans, which you would think of as your 401k and your savings for retirement. And so with that shift, there's been a big shift in alternatives, because pension funds, endowment funds, a lot of large institutions have long invested in alternative investments, things like real estate or private equity or venture capital or even infrastructure. And so now, how do we get these less liquid or illiquid, long duration type assets into individual investor retirement portfolios? And because they need the benefit of the higher return. Now, some of these alternatives do have higher risks. Some just have different types of risks. But for someone who is saving for retirement, and right now, if you're using mutual funds or ETFs to invest, you really only have access to public debt or public equity type securities. And we find that U.S. investors are heavily over-allocated to stocks, and in particular, large cap growth stocks. And so there's not the diversification. We all know the benefits of diversification in terms of enhancing returns and lowering risk. And so if people are overly concentrated in U.S. large cap growth or FANG stocks, things of that nature, you know, that doesn't bode well because, you know, you need a portfolio to have some resilience in a market downturn. So the size of this market is still fairly small. So it's about a half a trillion in assets under management in semi-liquid funds. So there's a number of types of alternative vehicles that individual investors can access. So right now it's about a half trillion. But if you think of the private fund space, typical drawdown private funds, that's about 22 trillion.
Wow.
Yeah. And so,
in context, the entire sort of marketplace that you're describing, interval funds, non-listed closed-end funds, and other other vehicles that a individual investor and their financial advisor, you know, could consider the universe of these diversifying strategies is a half a trillion, 500 billion,
right?
Compared to the traditional drawdown private fund world. So when you think about private equity, venture capital, private credit,
that's
infrastructure,
right,
that's over 20 trillion with a T.
That's right.
Wow.
That's right. And so that these statistics are coming from Preqin.
Wow.
But if you think about the addressable market, you know, who are the likely investors in these types of alternative products? So if, you know, in the United States, if you're an accredited investor, the cumulative wealth of accredited investors is about 73 trillion. And so, and that represents about 13 to 14 million households in the US. Now, the accredited investor standards are actually fairly low if you think about the prosperity of the average individual. And so the accredited investor definition, you know, there's been some talk about whether or not they change it. But
right
now, you know, there are a lot of households in the US, 13 to 14 million households that are suitable for a lot of these alternative products. Now, in the there are plenty of products that don't actually have any suitability restrictions at all. So they could be sold to anyone. Many of the credit products are this way. Now, financial advisors, it's their duty, and many of the brokerage firms will impose suitability restrictions. Many of them, for compliance reasons, will say you have to be an accredited investor to buy some of these alternatives. But
yeah. But so is it fair to say that there's growing demand from the retail audience for the reasons you mentioned? Fewer and fewer Americans have a defined benefit pension plan. More folks are going to have to save for retirement through a defined contribution plan or through a self-directed IRA or some type of other qualified account. And so they've got to navigate this universe, right? And increasingly want to avoid these really bad drawdowns like we saw after the GFC, you know, where people were very allocated to the stock market and saw if they were heavily allocated to the stock market, they could see 30, 40, 50% drawdowns in their portfolio. And then to sell at the bottom,
right,
you know, really, really a tough way to sort of then climb back if you're nearing retirement or in retirement.
Absolutely. I mean, that could really delay retirement by a number of years if you suffered that kind of severe drawdown. You know, even if you look at what happened in 2022, that's when a lot of the members of, you know, the asset management industry said, well, if 60 stocks, 40 bonds, you know, it didn't work in 2022, you lost money doing so. I think a lot of investors started questioning, you know, the validity of just investing in public stocks and bonds. And the reason for that, you know, we've all heard about unicorn stocks, companies staying private for longer for a lot of good reasons. But if you can't access the wealth creation that happens for these companies, you know, like a Palantir or other private companies
like SpaceX or
There's so many examples and particularly in the tech space. So people are missing out if they're not able to invest in these companies when they're at a smaller valuation or lower valuation and at an earlier stage of growth. And so the only way to tap into that would be private equity or venture capital. And so the demand is growing. Right now, it's largely the demand is coming from financial advisors. Many of the financial advisors are trying to differentiate their practice, you know, because if you have these terrific options from Apollo and Carlyle and Ares and other prestigious asset management firms, you know, you're able to attract investors, and you're able to offer them what now is sort of like an array of different alternatives. You know, you can't just have one or two of these products available. You need to have a suite across a number of different alternative asset classes.
Yeah. Yeah. It makes sense. So I think that's a real great sort of overview of the market size and some of the trends. Is there anything, and maybe we shift to point two, is there anything else that you think is driving the growth in alts outside of, let's say, retail demand or private wealth or financial advisor demand for some of these diversifying strategies? Are there other forces that are leading to this growth in alternatives over the last, call it, you know, 10 years?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the truth is that a lot of traditional asset managers, you know, what you would think of as mutual fund sponsors, they're also moving into the retail alternative space. If you think about it from their perspective, the mutual fund business is being cannibalized by ETFs, both mm-hmm. passive and active ETFs. So if they're looking at their assets are largely in mutual funds, what they need to protect the business, and they need to grow the business. And so you've seen a lot of traditional asset manager firms, you know, a BlackRock or a PIMCO or a Nuveen.
Franklin Templeton.
Yeah, the list goes on. And the reason I like those traditional asset managers moving into the space, you know, they may or may not be well known for their capabilities, but some of these firms like AllianceBernstein, they made an acquisition of CarVal, which is a $14 billion credit manager. And so through acquisition, oftentimes they're able to add these this expertise and alternatives. And I like the traditional firms moving into the space, partly because of the relationship that they already have with advisors and investors, and they're best able to educate.
Right. They've been doing it for years, right? Around things like small cap, emerging markets, debt.
That's right.
You know, the 60-40 allocation. So that completely makes sense. So we're seeing some of the growth is as a result of the asset management community recognizing, hey, if we're publicly traded, we need to continue to show Wall Street growth, or, you know, we are seeing outflows in our mutual fund business, right? And we're not going to start an ETF business to compete with BlackRock or Invesco or, you know, Schwab. So where's the growth? You're saying some of that's in the alternatives arena.
Yeah. And these are some of this is, you know, selfish motive in terms of firms trying to shore up their profit margins and things of that nature. But you're right. Many of them are public companies. And so they have to go where the growth is in the market. And the McKinsey research on this is very compelling. McKinsey talks about in asset management, there's going to be 20 to 25% growth over the next 5 to 10 years. And it is all on the alternative side of things. You know, the growth is not going to be coming from the traditional public debt and public equity type offerings. So it's driving a lot of M&A in the space. It's also driving a lot of product origination. So this is where the growth in the industry is going to come. And I think that the beauty of it is that it's going to be opening up access for a lot of people who otherwise would not have had it.
Yeah, I think one thing that you said a few minutes ago in discussing institutional investors have long invested and allocated to alternatives. When you look at the pension funds and the endowments, the foundations, you know, some of the Ivy League endowments have 50, 60% allocation to private markets. Obviously, an individual investor is a very different investor profile than, say, a $20 or $30 billion endowment. Nevertheless, could you comment before we go to point three in terms of talking about like your real specialization around product design and development? I'd love to get your thoughts around, there's been a lot of data that's come out around another factor that could be contributing to growth, and that's just simple math. When you look at the private wealth channel, and we could say that's everybody with $1 million of assets or less to invest, all the way up to say 10 million of assets to invest or more. So that's a odd universe. But their average allocation to alts is in the single digits. collectively. Yeah, is that true?
That's true. I think Cerulli has done the research and they say right now it's about 2.9% is the average alternative allocation. But I think what that average really reflects is that there are a lot of advisors who are active users and maybe have been for some years, you know, investing in real estate and things like that. So you have some investors who have much larger portfolios of alternatives, 20, 30%. And then you have many that are at zero. And sure. So the adoption is just really begun in terms of use of these products. And so we're going to see a big shift as more and more investors embrace this product set. Because with the 3% allocation to alternatives on average, you're not really moving the needle. You know, right. I think the advice is that you start to see benefits in terms of risk return at a 10 or 20% allocation.
Right. In terms of some of the things that an alternatives manager would say the allocation does to a portfolio, like volatility, you know, can address volatility, diversifier, all these things, lesser correlated, all this type of stuff. So
yes.
Very, very interesting. Yeah. Well, let's talk about product point three. And there's been a real evolution. You know, we have the SEC regime and their laws have been in place since the 30s. You know, and 40s, you hear the 40 Act and you hear the 33 and 34 Act, not to get into the history lesson here, but let's talk about the product evolution. What is allowing these asset managers to now tap into the retail marketplace and the private wealth? Is it new laws or is it going back and looking at how to sort of reinterpret what's already been on the books? Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I would say that it's more of an industry shift. The SEC registered product structures really haven't changed. It's really more of the embrace by members of the industry, and so a part of that is that, you know, if you look at why firms launch products, there's been sort of a tidal wave of high quality alternative managers embrace these product structures. And the wave of these semi-liquid alternatives started many years ago with non-listed REITs. And then it went from non-listed REITs, which, you know, REITs house real estate securities. Then you went to non-listed BDCs, business development companies. And those are largely middle market private debt of U.S. companies. And so those were product structures that preceded the modern sort of era of interval funds and tender funds. But there was an active user base of financial advisors who saw the benefits of having real estate or having a middle market debt in terms of yield enhancement. And so over the last 25 years, I think that there's been a lot of education about the benefits of those less liquid or semi-liquid products. And so an interval fund, the rules have been, you know, on the books since the late 80s. And it's really just been in the last 10 years that firms have said, okay, well, what is an interval fund? An interval fund is a continuously offered product, just like a mutual fund. You know, it's available for sale. It's a perpetual product. And you can, many interval funds are daily net asset values, so you can get into a fund daily. The difference is the interval speaks to when you get liquidity. And so most interval funds have quarterly liquidity. So that means you can get out once a quarter, but to the extent, and it's limited though, there's typically it's a 5% liquidity provision. And so if
on a quarterly basis,
right. So that would be 20% for the year. But if too many people want out at the same quarter, your demand for liquidity will be subject to proration. And so you may not be able to get out fully in this quarter. You may have to wait to the next quarter or to the following quarter. And so that's something that we always talk about being mindful with semi-liquid products. You do need to have a longer investment horizon that aligns with these product structures. So, you know, typically it's a 3 to 5 year type outlook so that you can manage through a market cycle. You know, in March of 2020, you know, that's not the moment to pull or to try to sell out of an alternative product, or because everybody's going to be presumably wanting liquidity. So we would suggest that in that optimal portfolio asset allocation, you be thinking about what are the sources of liquidity that I need to tap when I intend to create liquidity for myself. And alternatives are an area where you would want to keep them aside and have that longer investment horizon. And so it's one of the considerations that when you go into an interval fund, you need to be mindful of the exit, you know, is subject to proration.
Yeah. So let's say I'm an asset manager. I run a private debt or alternative lending strategy, but I do it in a private fund, call it a private fund wrapper. So it's an LP structure. Of course, there's accredited investor requirements to invest in a private vehicle or private fund like mine, but I'm hearing more and more of my peers that are exploring these interval funds or these tender offer funds. I approach, you know, XA and I say, I have this fund. I've been running it for a decade. You know, I've got $700-900 million in capital. Okay. And maybe I have multiple funds to accommodate, you know, lots of LPs. I've got an offshore fund. Talk about the types of questions that you'd be asking that asset manager, and maybe they're already working with a handful of financial advisors.
I think that interval funds are meant to house the same types of strategies that fit into a private fund, and okay. So you know there are some trade-offs, for example, with leverage limitations. So if you're running a convertible arbitrage strategy or a highly levered type strategy, then you know it may not be a good fit. But for most private fund strategies, you can get them to fit very well in an interval fund. And I think some of those, the thought process is that what we're hearing now is that when someone is in to talk with a family office about their private fund, they're in to talk with a Merrill Lynch gatekeeper, let's say a large hedge fund goes in to talk about their new private fund. What's happening now is that it's coming from the gatekeepers, the family office, the RA, the large broker dealer firm, and they'll say, listen, we like your private fund strategy, but it will work better for more of our clients if you can structure it as an SEC registered product. And the interval fund, you know, it has 1099s, it has better transparency, and it has an independent board. So these are things that gatekeepers really like if they're going to onboard a new alternative product, even if they're already familiar with you and familiar with your private fund. The interval fund is now being, a multifamily office called it the easy button for their advisors, because if you're going to spend the time to diligence a new investment, an alternative investment, you want to make sure that most of your clients, it will be a good fit for them. And so you need something that works for everyone. And a lot of clients don't want K-1s. And so your private fund is not going to be a good fit for them. Mm-hmm. And so that eliminates a big group of your client base, unless you're only serving, you know, the wealthiest people in America. But most advisors have a mix of clientele, very high end. Maybe they'll still offer private funds for those people, but for the rest of their clients, they need a solution. And that's what these registered interval funds allow for. The same is true for a BDC. Blackstone has been able to change how people think about the non-listed BDC structure. And so a lot of RAs and family offices have invested in non-listed BDCs. And so we're expecting a lot of BDCs come to market in the coming years. Any credit manager that runs that kind of strategy is likely to bring a non-listed BDC to market. And so same is true. I mean, you want a product that is easy for an advisor to be able to speak to clients about and has some of these investor benefits like a 1099.
Yeah. Yeah. The belt, I always use the analogies. There's so many of these terms thrown around in our industry, but the belt and suspenders, I'm thinking board, NAVs, you know, independent trustees, you know, all these things in the private fund world. Literally, I heard a lawyer say last week, you know, in a private fund document, you really just have a contract between you and your LPs and whatever they kind of agree to in that operating agreement, if they even read it, right, the manager is really allowed to do. And that's led to some unfortunate, you know, blow ups in the private fund world. I don't know how many people are crying over it other than those clients, because, you know, these are folks that are quote unquote accredited, sophisticated. But when you're talking about the RIA, financial advisor, broker dealer world, now you're talking about suitability, you're talking about fiduciary standards, you're talking about research teams. There's a lot more comfort, if I'm hearing what you're saying, that can come from some of the aspects that go into getting approval from the SEC with a tender fund or an interval fund.
Yes, I think they're becoming more acceptable, more common. You know, it's not as common as a mutual fund yet, but I think we'll get there in terms of how advisors, you know, how familiar are you with the structure, with the benefits and the limitations of the structure. And so the interval fund has become an interval fund, you know, can house any alternative asset. You name it, it will likely fit into an interval fund. And so I think that's why it's become a little bit more of a universal package than a non-listed REIT or a non-listed BDC, because those per regulatory requirements, you know, a REIT has to have real estate eligible securities. A BDC has to have either debt or equity of a U.S. middle market company. And so interval funds, I think, are becoming easier and easier once an advisor sort of understands, okay, you know, this here, you know, I can get in daily, but I have to get out on a quarterly basis, and it will likely be limited. I think you get more comfortable with how it should be used in the portfolio and how you should talk with clients about it, because it is a very different conversation if they've never invested in private equity or some of these longer duration assets. I think there's a lot of interest, just as an example right now, in infrastructure, because mm-hmm. we're all sort of feeling the effects of inflation on the wallet. And infrastructure is a type of asset that really benefits. There's a number of new interval funds in the space. But yet, you know, an infrastructure is a very long-lived asset. You know, these are, you know,
ports and highways and major
toll roads exactly. And so the mindset that you have to invest in infrastructure, if you're a pension and endowment and you have a 50 or 100 year investment horizon, you know, makes a lot of sense. And so not every, you know, retail investor is going to find that infrastructure is a good fit, despite the fact that it has a lot of these inflation protection benefits naturally built into those types of assets. So I think that's a good example of a really attractive alternative asset that may or may not be appropriate for everyone, just given the long-lived nature of those assets. And the long-lived nature of an asset means is that when you do go to sell the asset, you know, it's going to take a long time. You know, mm-hmm. it's going to take longer than selling your house, potentially, sure. If you're selling an airport or if you're selling a toll road, right? You've got to find the right buyer.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think that, you know, the point of 3 and 4 were to kind of get an understanding and education a little bit. We could spend a lot of time on just the product design questions and does it work, but I want to keep the conversation moving. And let's say that my strategy as an asset manager does work in an interval fund. I am interested in distributing this to a much broader audience. I do want to offer the benefits of a lower minimum, a 1099, you know, a continuously struck NAV, et cetera. So let's talk about some of the challenges and the hurdles in point five.
Sure.
And you have this white paper that I really am intrigued by, the term, the valley of death. It sounds ominous, but I'm sure that there's some wisdom in what that means for our listeners.
We did. We took it from the tech industry, but I think it applies to an interval fund. So, when you're organizing an interval fund, there's a point at which the assets of the fund support, you know, you've sufficiently scaled the fund. And we talk about a new fund having about 100 million in assets so that it can pay for its own expenses. There's a lot of fixed costs in running an interval fund. And so there's a lot of time and effort that we spend with clients helping them think through, because it's interval funds are not cheap. And they're not fast to launch. If you wanted cheaper fast, you would just create a new private fund, because those mm-hmm. are actually pretty cost effective and you can do it pretty quickly. An interval fund will take at least 6 months to build, and given the legal costs, because you're talking about a 40 Act product, you've got to engage outside counsel, 40 Act experts to help you build the fund. Good law firms are pricey. And yep. so it's very different than launching a private fund. And so that's why the Valley of Death is referring to, if you build it, they will come. That's not typically what happens here, because mm-hmm. if you're an investor, you don't want to necessarily be the first person into a small fund.
Yeah.
So it's a chicken and egg problem. And we work with our consulting clients on how to either get seed capital or lead capital. Some of our clients will contribute existing private funds to the launch of an interval fund. And some of them will stand up a brand new private fund, and they'll call it maybe a conversion fund for purposes of converting it into an interval fund. So these are all examples of how do you avoid the Valley of Death, because you know if your fund is sitting at 40 million and you're trying to sell it, you're having a hard time on the sales side, but you're also probably you've probably got fee waivers on, because nobody wants to buy an expensive fund because it hasn't scaled. And so it's costing you quite a bit as an asset manager to fund those fee waivers out of pocket. And so I would say that, you know, the reason we conduct feasibility studies for clients is this is a very central issue to launching a fund. 5 years ago, there were plenty of interval funds that did start at zero, but I think a lot of asset managers learned these lessons the hard way. Mm-hmm. And we, you do see funds, small subscale funds under 100 million, they will close because it's too expensive to keep them open. It's just like, you know, that's why you see a lot of ETFs that don't hit it big, and they've also got to close, because here it's just more expensive. I think with a lot of mutual funds and ETFs, you can be really cost effective and you can add them to a series trust. With interval funds, they are a type of closed end fund. So each fund is a separate legal entity. So that's another thing kind of driving the Valley of Death specific to an interval fund. So something to bear in mind. And so I think if you're a private fund manager, you might contemplate one of the things I said, which is take an existing private fund, and if the investors are willing, you could use that to start an interval fund. Or sometimes people will start a new private fund, and then maybe a year later they would convert it. So I think it's time well spent up front planning ahead, so that you are successful and that you have a scaled fund. Because then when you're speaking with RAs and you're speaking with family offices, they are, you know, the sale process is much easier, because there's, you know, you take objections off the table when you do this the right way.
Yeah, that's super helpful. As far as the manager that's considering launching an interval fund, are there other hurdles like out of the gate? You talked about the fixed expenses. You talked about the time frame of being at, you know, could take you 6 months. Are there any other things before we get into just growing, you know, in point six? Is there anything else that are just out of the gate, things that a manager should be mindful of that are going to get flushed out in a feasibility analysis that you all work with?
Yeah, those are so economics is actually where we always start, because if it doesn't mm-hmm. make economic sense for the manager, you're not going to be able to build a competitive product that has appropriate fees for the end investor.
But you could save them 3 years and millions of dollars. I mean,
Totally.
Yeah.
And time is so valuable, right?
Sure.
You don't want to do that. And so the common, understanding the economics for the manager, understanding the economics for the investor, is it a competitive fee? And really, so I would say the biggest mistakes that people make when people don't really have a good handle on their competition, and in the competition in this market is growing. And so that's what we help them understand, is that, you have a lot, you may have, five direct competitors, but you've got, 20 indirect competitors. And then I would say the other area of issues, it's a little bit like an iceberg. We always talk about there's a lot of problems under the water, under the surface, and that's what they're going to pop up or crop up at some point in the process, even if you haven't identified them up front. And that's what my team is really good at tackling those issues, keeping you moving down a product launch timetable. But some of the issues that what happens is that there are asset class specific issues that come up. So if you're talking about private equity as an example, most of the interval funds in private equity are fund of private funds.
Right.
So if you're a fund of private funds, and let's say StepStone is an example, or AMG Pantheon as an example, they allocate to various private funds. Some of them also do co-invest, or some maybe a little bit of direct investing. But if there are SEC rules governing fund of private funds, because the SEC is concerned about layers of fees for retail investors. And so you just have to be mindful of some of those asset class specific issues. But if you're a fund of private funds, then the result is there's an unwritten rule that the SEC requires the registered fund to be sold only to accredited investors with a minimum investment of $25,000.
Okay.
Now, that is fine for most asset managers. You'd say, okay, that makes a lot of sense. But a $25,000 minimum is pretty high, right? Mm-hmm. And you're trying to create a product that's broadly saleable. And so anytime you have a higher suitability standard, accredited investor for a private equity fund, most of the credit funds are, there's no suitability restrictions. So you end up shrinking your audience every time there's a restriction put in place. And so you have to be mindful of some of those asset class specific issues. Now, the competitors that exist in the market have dealt with it, have been successful even with that in mind. But there are a lot of things that you have to bear in mind that kind of are definitely asset class specific.
Yeah. Well, I hate to just keep the questions coming, but this is just really good information for those folks out there that are, just really, whether they're a financial advisor, and I think what you just said is good due diligence information, honestly, because if a person shows up and says, hey, we've got this brand new interval fund, it just launched, what you just said is, is there a track record? Are you converting? What's the story? How long can you support the fund? What's your coverage, expense coverage ratio? I mean, there's a lot of things you said there that also could benefit the advisor doing diligence. But let's talk about some of the challenges to growth. Is there anything else that you would say? The cost, clearly, in economics. What about just selling these funds? Is that continuing to be a challenge to match the distribution firepower of some of the bigger asset managers? Or maybe there are other challenges that, that asset managers, like you said, are hidden below the surface.
Yeah, I do think that most of the interval funds are focused initially on the RIA marketplace. And so, they're a very sophisticated group of investors. And so if your sales team is not sufficiently sophisticated and can't help them understand alternatives, and so you'll have a challenge, like if you're dealing with a traditional mutual fund wholesaling group that's not experienced selling alternatives, you're going to have to bring in some alt specialists to partner up with your existing sales team. And so, I mean, there are definitely challenges to growth. And it's what's surprising sometimes is some of these big firms with big established sales teams, you say, well, you just need to incentivize them or get them to sell the alternative product. It's actually very hard because it is a complex sell. It's a lot easier just to sell that large cap growth equity or the municipal bond fund that they've always been selling. And so sometimes the challenges are different if you're a large firm and, you know, you have to come up with a completely different sales incentive scheme. You have to come up with, you know, an educational component and an alt specialist team. And so it takes a lot, even if you have salespeople. So some of the surprising success stories in the interval fund market are firms that don't have 100 salespeople. Maybe they have two, or maybe they have five, but they have very good relationships with RIAs. And the firm as a whole, you know, it might be the only product or one of two or three products that they sell. And so that level of focus allows them to be successful. And so when we talk about like what it takes to address some of these challenges of growing, once you've reached that scale point of north of 100 million, definitely gets a lot easier. And so, because at that point, you know, if you're selling into the RIA channel, you've been able to successfully open up Schwab and Fidelity, which is not easy to do. I mean, these products represent manual processing given the quarterly repurchases. So they're not particularly excited. It's not just the flip of the switch to onboard at Fidelity and Schwab the way it might be with the mutual fund. And so we see a lot of different firms being successful different ways. And so we'll for our clients, when we're doing feasibility studies, we'll talk about kind of the quantitative and the qualitative reasons that certain firms have been successful. Everybody assumes it's sales. And sometimes it's surprising because it's like, well, they have two salespeople and maybe they are the most amazing salespeople. There is a limited supply of really talented alternative focused salespeople in, you know, in the country. That is for sure. So I think that some of the secrets to success are, you know, using, you know, the strengths that you have. Some firms do have brand, but you don't need brand to be successful. Some people will compete on price. You know, Cliffwater, which is the market leader, they were an institutional consultant. They weren't a particularly well-known asset manager.
Yeah.
But you know, Steve Nesbitt was well known for direct lending and he wrote a book on it and they parlayed that into a tremendous success and a $19 billion AUM fund. And a lot of institutional consultants that are much, much larger than Cliffwater are, they're you know, shocked, amazed at what was done there. And, you know, their sales team obviously has grown as that fund has grown, but I believe they started out with two dedicated salespeople. And so you can invest continue to invest in your, and this is what I think is exciting for a lot of alternative boutiques is that you don't have to have 100 salespeople.
Yeah.
You don't even have to have 20 salespeople because you can pace the investment into sales and distribution along with the growth of the fund. But that's what makes the launch so critical.
So important.
To allow you to be able to invest as you go.
Yeah, that front end work, as you're talking and our show continues, I just keep thinking, why in the goodness of just time savings and resource allocation would a firm not just conduct a feasibility study before, you know, diving in and hiring a lawyer, you know? But you know, I know it happens, you know?
We talked a little bit about how a lot of firms, even if this is not an appropriate opportunity for you in 2024, you know, and something you're thinking about in 2025, you know, we talk with everyone that calls us, you know, very small firms. We talk with our RIAs who want to launch proprietary funds. It's good to be thinking about it now. And then that way, when you are ready to pursue it, you know, you're really well positioned to go do it. And it's such, a lot of people call me, you know, kind of freaking out that they've missed the boat. Their CEO said, hey, we have to have an interval fund. And they don't even know what an interval fund really is. They just are hearing about it. So that's why the feasibility study is so important, because you can spend 6 months just trying to read up on what this means. But if you're not applying it to your firm and the asset class where you specialize, then a lot of it's just kind of noise. And so it's really, really very valuable. And we think it's really valuable, even if you say, hey, this is not for us. We've had plenty of clients that say, this just doesn't make economic sense for us, mm-hmm. or frankly, we have another higher priority. We're launching a non-listed BDC right now. We'll circle back to this in a year as the market expands and grows.
Let's talk about maybe an important but lesser known way of getting out of the gate. And you mentioned boutique alternative managers. Talk about sub-advising and talk about partnerships and how that fits into the conversation. Not everybody is going to go sponsor their own fund like yes. Cliffwater did. Some of them are going to partner. Yes. You guys have your own fund that's sub-advised by a very well-known, you know, CLO equity and debt firm there in your backyard. So just, I'd love for you to touch on that.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm actually going to be speaking at a couple conferences, the Sub-Advisory Institute and the Sub-Advised Funds Forum, for this very reason, because some asset managers, they want to remain institutional client focused. Mm-hmm. And so for them, sub-advisory is really a great fit. So the good news is here is that we're seeing more interval funds being launched with sub-advisors. An example of this is Jackson National. They have filed with the SEC for a credit product that's being sub-advised by Neuberger Berman. And another example would be Scion. Scion is an interval fund advisor. They have a fund successful collaboration with Ares. Yep. And that fund is quite large. It's north of $3 billion. And Ares, now Scion has a second sub-advisor. They're partnering with a Chicago-based firm, Grosvenor, sure. on an infrastructure product. And so we're seeing more and more of these examples. And sub-advisory, I think, can be an excellent fit for firms that don't want to be building out a retail sales force. And frankly, maybe they don't have the operational or back office systems to support it either. And so mm-hmm. a partnership approach is a better way to go. My firm, we do partner with sub-advisors as well. And, we think we can be a very good, there's a very good division of labor oftentimes between advisor and sub-advisor, because there's a lot to do here with an alternative product in terms of marketing, in terms of education, and
registrations, filings, all that, right?
Yeah. And sometimes the sub-advisor says, hey, I just want to focus on portfolio management, mm-hmm. and that's what I want to do. And then, of course, as an advisor, sub-advisor, you see fee splits that are commensurate with that division of labor. Usually, it's somewhere around 50-50 or 60-40 in terms of those fee splits. So there's plenty of firms that say, hey, that works for us. We're willing to do that. There's a lot of firms that say, well, I don't want to split economics 50%. Mm-hmm. And so if they say, I want to own it, I want 100% of the economics, then you're talking about going down the pathway of building a proprietary fund. And there's some investment of time and investment of standing that up. But particularly if you're an alternative manager that envisions a platform, 2, 3, 4, 5, 10 products, that may be the road for you. If you're a firm that says, well, we've got a couple different capabilities, we could see ourselves sub-advising 1 or 2 products, that also might factor into your decision.
Yeah, very interesting. Let's put the spotlight here. We have a couple more that I'd love to hit on. Let's put the spotlight on the advisor. The financial advisor, is inundated with options, right, for how to build portfolios. We've talked about ETFs and mutual funds. Now we're, looking at alternatives. But at the end of the day, if you're going to get traction with an advisor, an RIA, they're sophisticated. These are, a lot of them came out of wirehouses. They came from the industry and they set up their own firm. But even the wirehouses have gatekeepers, research teams. We use the term gatekeeper. That means the research team that's going to vet and diligence the product. How do we appeal to them? And as an FA, what should I be looking for, just as I explore these interval funds and start to think about whether they're a good fit for my practice?
Yes. So I think for advisors, you have to help them understand a couple of different things. Some advisors are going to want to understand how it fits in the portfolio. Is this going to go into some separate alts bucket, or is the product that you're selling me going to be a good substitute for, you know, are you going to reduce some of your public equity exposure and put a 5% or 10% allocation to private equity? So help them think about, you know, the fit in the portfolio. One of the things too, that particularly as we see a proliferation of credit, credit is the biggest category within the interval fund market. So as now that that is, that segment of the market is a bit more crowded than others, but there's a lot of diversity in the terms of the type of strategies. You know, you have some that are kitchen sink credit funds, some that are asset-backed lending funds, some that are real estate debt funds. And so I think what you have to, just as we do with mutual fund education, we have to help the advisor understand the unique merits of that strategy. You know, how does it compare to what Cliffwater is doing in the lending space? Because a lot of advisors are invested in the Blackstone BREIT product. They're invested in BCRED,
right,
which is
the credit product. Yeah.
Yeah, they're invested in Cliffwater. And so you have to say, okay, well, you know, direct lending is great, but here's the benefit of, you know, this new product being a substitution. So we are at that point where we're saying, okay, you know, you may want to diversify your alternative exposure as well. With the reason credit has exploded in size is because credit funds from, you know, in the first year of operations, you're able to declare oftentimes a monthly or quarterly distribution. So that product has a current yield. Many of these products are 8, 9, 10, 12, 13% current yields. So you get a substantial yield pickup, maybe 200-300 basis points more than you could with traditional fixed income. And so that's fair. That's an easy story to talk with advisors about, about, you know, here's what you get from alternative credit that you're not getting right now from high yield or senior loans. And so you get this incremental yield pickup with maybe not much risk difference. And so that's a really compelling story. And I think advisors understand that. But as more and more alternative strategies come to market, you have to think about what's complementary to existing positions, you know, and make the case. And I think a lot of asset managers are trying to expand the alts bucket, but there are some natural limitations from the legal and compliance side that, you know, even FINRA is suggesting that there should be a limit on how much can go into alternatives. So as an advisor, if you're already an active user of real estate, you may not have much budget or much of an allocation left to put into these other types of products like an infrastructure interval fund or a private equity interval fund. And so there is this sort of budgeting of allocation given some of these constraints. So I think that's, and as more and more products come, what comes with that for advisors is some of the noise, which can overwhelm the advisor. And that's not good for the industry. And so it does go back to, you know, to break through some of that noise. It is going to be more of where do you have the relationship? You know, where have you been able to provide that advisor with education? That's how firms are going to be successful cultivating that relationship with the advisor. Because I think there is going to be the noise, the volume is just going to be turned up as we see these markets expand. Because there will be a ton of new entrants. The pipeline is very full. There's about 35 funds in the SEC registration process now, just in the interval and tender fund space.
Wow. And yeah, just, I'm going to plug your firm because I know you guys are even starting to offer, you know, resources, education, and I would call it tools for advisors around just categorization of the private credit allocation, you know, because like you said, just because you have one allocation to, you know, one gigantic private credit firm doesn't mean you're diversified. And there are a lot of other opportunities to generate yield within credit, right? You mentioned CLOs, there's middle market lending, there's large corporate enterprise syndicated loan lending, right, and on and on and on. So I think that's really interesting. And I would assume more and more advisors are going to be looking for that. When you think about the Morningstar style box, I always go back to that, and you see the mutual funds and there's all these different categories, large cap, all the way down to small cap, you know, emerging markets, whatnot. I could see alternatives also, and, you know, credit, for example, having something similar over time.
I agree. Like right now, the menus are pretty small, partly because the research, you know, groups and gatekeepers have limited, you know, they're only able to keep up with onboarding funds at sort of a slower pace. And so in some ways that's okay, because advisors, particularly firms or advisors that are newer to this structure, they need to get comfortable with the structure, how they position it with clients. And then over time, this menu of options is going to open up. You know, you may not ever have as many options as you do in the mutual fund space, but you're going to have a lot more options. And I think advisors have a voice. They have some power with the clearing firms. They also have power with the gatekeepers to say, like, if you really like a manager and you really like a product, that right now is some of the most powerful because these products are being built for you, the advisor, to use mm-hmm. with your clients. And so everybody in the ecosystem, they primarily care what you think as the advisor.
Sure. And yeah, so they have a lot of agency at the end of the day, right?
That's
you may
right.
be running $500 million, and Schwab wants to keep those assets in custody at Schwab, you know, so that they don't go to Fidelity or they don't go elsewhere, right? So if you call up your rep at Schwab
right.
and say, you know, I really like this. These folks are doing it, you know, in a unique way. I think they're going to listen, right?
They will. They will.
So,
they of course they will. And
talk about getting out of the gate, right? Like call the Schwab rep and say, or Fidelity rep and say, you know, I have $1 billion with you. I'm going to start doing more in alts. And I really like these, you know, managers, but they're not on your platform, you know?
Right. Right.
Somebody's going to be doing some diligence.
It's very, very powerful. I think it really, the decision making is with the advisor, and that is really what gives them a lot of that power and agency, as you described.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've gone into overtime, I should say. I usually do these shows for 50 minutes, but we've had so much good content from you, and I really appreciate your time. But I want to finish by letting you sort of take a minute or two and just explain how you. You know, you've kind of done that through the feasibility format we've talked about today, but how do you all work with asset managers or just other types of clients? I know you have the two parts of your practice, but I'd love to give you the final word.
Absolutely. So we are constantly talking with financial advisors and asset managers about the interval fund market. We have a research business, and so we don't end up working with everyone that calls us, but we're always willing to share what we know. We've got a lot of white papers and resources on our website, and so we're here to help, you know, further the interval fund ecosystem. Our consulting practice is one way that we're able to help asset managers enter the marketplace. And so, you know, we can be a good resource for information. We actually do have specific educational materials just for advisors too. So please don't hesitate to contact us if you're looking for information. Right now, it's still a little bit hard to find information on some of these interval and tender funds. So we're happy to be a resource.
Yeah, I'm going to go back here just for a minute to, you know, how folks can get in touch with you. There at the bottom of the slide, there's, you know, your firm's website, your email address. And I also, you know, put your LinkedIn, because I know you're very active and out there providing information. And you also speak at a number of conferences and provide a lot of great resources to the industry. So with that, I really want to wish you and the team at XA Investments continued success. Really enjoyed hearing an update and getting a chance to reconnect and just marvel really at the amount of depth and growth that it sounds like we're going to see continue in the interval fund market in the years ahead.
Yes, it's exciting. It's a good time in the industry, and I think there's a lot of energy around it. So please, we welcome further conversation, and thank you so much, Andres, for taking the time.
Yeah, really enjoyed it, Kimberly. Have a great rest of your week, and I look forward to us bumping into one another on the road or catching up on another show soon.
That'd be great.
Thank you.